Translation. In Gaya, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was initiated by Ishwara Puri, and immediately afterwards he exhibited signs of love of Godhead. He again displayed such symptoms after returning home. Purport. When Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu went to Gaya, accompanied by many of his disciples, he became sick on the way. He had such a high fever that he asked his students to bring water that had washed the feet of the Brahmins. And when they brought it, the Lord drank it and was cured. Okay, Govinda, you're getting the picture here? Therefore, everyone should respect the position of a Brahmin, as indicated by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Neither the Lord nor his followers displayed any disrespect to Brahmanas. Okay, got that principle? That's principle number one. First half of the purport. Second half of the purport. The followers of the Lord must be prepared to offer Brahmins all due respect. But preachers of Lord Chaitanya's cult object if someone presents himself as a Brahmin without having the necessary qualifications. The followers of Lord Chaitanya cannot blindly accept that everyone born in a Brahmin family is a Brahmin. Therefore, one should not indiscriminately follow the Lord's example of showing respect to Brahmins by drinking water that has washed their feet. Gradually, the Brahmin families have become degraded because of the contamination of Kali Yuga. Thus, they misguide people by exploiting their sentiments. Oma jnana timirandasya jnananjana shalakaya chakshurun militam jena tasmai shi gurave namaha. It's always my pleasure to be sitting here at Bhaktivedanta Manor before you all, bright-faced, intelligent, thoughtful, and very attentive listeners, Hare Krishna. And it's always my privilege to be sitting here with the hundreds of you that are sitting at home watching this as you have your breakfasts. And think about what you're going to do on a Saturday. So if you're watching this at home, I can see you. We have a two-way technology here. So here it says Chaitanya Mahaprabhu went to Gaya with his disciples. But if we look at the 32 names in the front of the Bhagavad Gita, we see the parampara. We don't see anything about these disciples. What's going on? Who can answer me the question? Who are these disciples that must be in the parampara because they've taken initiation from Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and we don't hear anything about them. We don't even hear their names. What's going on? Who can tell me? Not necessarily Govinda, because he's sharp. Someone who's less sharp. Now, no, nobody wants to put their hand out. Sir, what's going on? Yes. Yes. This is good. Go to the top of the class. They were disciples of Nimai Pandit. They were disciples of Nimai Pandit. Now, when you take initiation, it just means the beginning. It comes from the, we translated initiation. It comes from the Sanskrit word initiare, which means the beginning. Sounds much more continental, doesn't it? Initiare. It means the beginning of something. So when the queen takes a bottle of champagne on a long piece of string and smashes it on the side of a battleship, and she says, I name this ship HMS, whatever it is, she's performing a rite of initiation. It's a rite of initiation. It's the beginning of something. It's the beginning of a battleship. Okay? Did you take initiation? Yes. I got bathed in champagne in the dockyard at Glasgow. That's when I took my initiation. So initiation, you can get initiated into being in the Royal Dragoons. They initiate you. They will stick you inside a barrel and they'll roll you down a hill. That's the initiation ceremony. Or you can get initiated as a member of a college fraternity in America. You know, they have these fraternities that all begin with three Greek letters, Kappa, Beta, Theta. I'm having my initiation ceremony tonight. It usually means they chase you around the dormitories with wet towels. So for any position, any membership, and any course of study, you have an initiation. So Prabhupada was in, Prabhupada said two things, interestingly, two things. He said, when he was in Krishna Balaram temple, when they were installing the deities of Krishna Balaram, he said, you better find local Brahmins who can perform the rites, otherwise the local people will not think that Krishna Balaram have been installed. He said, but actually the real installation is the chanting of Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. And we think that's the end of the story, don't we, normally? That's the story that we tell, that we don't need all these rituals, we don't need all these ceremonies. However, fast forward to Hyderabad, and the deities are being installed there, and devotees are watching, and the local Brahmins are again doing it, and Prabhupada then says to his disciples, he said, some of you should learn how to do these installation ceremonies. So he said, you can learn from these priests. At that time, Prabhupada had someone, he was very famous in the Sri Vaishnava world, Sampat Kumar Bhattacharya. And he came, and he was so famous, and he got on really well with Prabhupada, and Prabhupada got on well with him. And he said, you should learn from them how to do these things. So one devotee went away. His name was Gaura Keshava. He went down to South India to begin learning. But then after a few days, he came back to Srila Prabhupada and he said, Srila Prabhupada, they say that if they can only teach me how to do these pujas and ceremonies if I become initiated. Okay? So now what would you have said? What would you have said? Okay? What would you have said? Ladies, what would you say? Huh? What do you think Prabhupada said? Ah, these fools and rascals, I am their guru, I am your guru, you do not need any more initiations, simply bogus rascals. What do you think Prabhupada said? He said, yes, take initiation. That's a Gaura Keshava. Prabhupada, take initiation. That is the, he said, is initiation into learning how to do pujas and ceremonies. Okay? So Gaura Keshava did that, and it doesn't mean that he wasn't Prabhupada's disciple. So there are different initiations for different things. And I just wanted to say that because we often think of the word initiation as exclusively Vaishnava initiation, exclusively Gaudiya Vaishnava initiation, exclusively ISKCON Gaudiya Vaishnava initiation. Initiations are taking place today many thousands of times. In India, many young boys get initiated at the age of 8. So hundreds of young men between the ages of 8 and 16 will be initiated today in India. And tomorrow, and tomorrow, and tomorrow. Well, it's like in the church, they have the baptism. Or in Judaism, they have the bar mitzvah. This is an initiation into manhood, an initiation into the life of the church or the life of the religion. It's a new beginning. Okay? So, however, if you want to make progress, there is a series of initiations you go through. In our tradition, we have kind of three, don't we? We say we have two, but we have three. Actually, we have four, if you look at it. We have first initiation. But before first initiation, does anybody wear tilak? Yes. People wear tilak from day one, don't they? Does anybody chant the mantra before initiation? Of course they do, everybody. So we're actually initiating people with the Hare Krishna mantra before they get initiated. That's an initiation. As soon as you meet the first devotee who says, actually, you know what? You should chant this mantra, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Krishna, because you've initiated that person with a mantra. You've given them a mantra, except we just don't call it initiation. Because initiation for us means not nama parad, not nama bas, but initiation means the dedication to chant Shudanam, or the pure name of the Lord. And the way you do that is by agreeing to follow the four regulated principles. So that comes as the clause. You see? So that's what we call initiation. But previously, you've been initiated. Does anybody wear neck beads? before they get initiated? Yes, they do. And then, hang on a minute, we give them neck beads during the initiation ceremony. Huh? Does that make sense? We give them the Hare Krishna mantra during the initiation ceremony. I've had this for 10 years. No, because the Hare Krishna mantra is not syllables. It's not syllables. It becomes Sri Krishna himself when it's Shudanam, when you agree to chant according to these rules and regulations. Do you see? So then we have second initiation, which in India is your first initiation. Okay, you get that when you're 8 to 16. Okay, and then we get it with our converts to Krishna consciousness. We get it a little later. And then, of course, you may have sannyas initiation like that. So there's different initiations provided for. Anytime you begin a new stage of life, a wedding is also an initiation, isn't it, Guru Narayan? You're being initiated, isn't it? It's also, you're being initiated into a new stage of life. So we do the same thing. You make certain promises before the sacred fire. Okay, you make certain promises before the sacred fire. That's an initiation, isn't it? Initiare is a new beginning. Okay, so I just thought I would say that. So here's Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and in token of his new beginning, he begins to reveal his ecstatic symptoms. More of that at the end. I want to talk about Brahmins and foot washing and these things, because sometimes our devotees, you know, we confuse Brahmin initiation with being a Brahmin. Actually, being a Brahmin means a whole host of qualities that you need to develop before you can identify as a Brahmin, or before someone else identifies you as a Brahmin. And it's not just a piece of string, as Prabhupada said. It is not just, he said, a piece of string that runs from here to here on a Brahmin's chest. He said, this can be bought for 2 paisa in the marketplace. We used to have devotees. They went to India, and they would come back sometimes with a Brahmin thread. They weren't initiated. They just, you know, they bought it in the marketplace, and they saw Prabhuji, you have to wait. You have to wait until the spiritual master gives you that 2 paisa piece of string, because then it is a symbol of something else that you've received. It's not the string that makes you a Brahmin. It is what you agree to follow, that what you have signed up for. We had one devotee came back one time with a Brahmin thread made of pure gold. He came from a very rich family. He came from Switzerland. And I remember speaking to him right here in the temple room, and he came in. In those days, you see the old photographs of the devotees. Often devotees would walk around bare-chested because we didn't have many kurtas. And because we liked, you know, we thought that was really spiritual. God knows what everybody else thought. But you'll see old photographs of devotees, and they're all bare-chested, isn't it? Los Angeles, they're all bare-chested. It works well when you're 20, not so well when you're 40. And so he had this, he'd obviously got a suntan in India, and he had this solid gold Brahmin thread. And he said he went on to become a famous lawyer, actually. I don't know, you know, where he is now, but he says, yeah, I know I have the Brahmin thread. He's from Germany. It's from Austria. Did I say Austria? Switzerland. I have the Brahmin thread. Look, it's so nice. And we said, let's talk about this. And so what we are engaged in is we go through a series of initiations in order to rise higher. In the Krishna consciousness or in life generally, you'll never get initiated into something that takes power away from you or that gives you less knowledge, unless you're joining a fraternity of, you know, Milton Keynes, you know, Satan worshippers or something like that. You should never get initiated into something that will take power away. And really, no one wants to be disempowered. We want to have power. We want to be empowered. When we are initiated, we want to be more educated. So this is the thing. There are 3 modes of nature: sattva guna and rajaguna and tamaguna. And these permeate everything we do, everything we think, everything we are in this material world. And the soul is floating in these three modes of nature, being pushed and pulled. And as Ridai Nanda Maharaj likes to explain, vana means the wind that causes the waves that push you around. In his Bhagavad Gita commentary, he said, vana, this means wind. He said, so when you're no longer being pushed around by the waves of the three modes of material nature, when the wind is no longer affecting the soul, this is known as nirvana. It's the actual definition of the word, nirvana. So we're all aiming for that nirvana, but not the shunyavad nirvana of nothingness or emptiness, but the brahma nirvana of, or parabrahman nirvana of, firstly, not being moved by the waves of material energy. That's the main thing. We're trying to break free. Okay. So then we have these two considerations. These days in politics, in more modern political discourse, modern political conversations, we have this sort of sub-discussion going on, which is known as identity politics. You must have seen on your social media feed lots of pieces about identity politics, and often this is race politics, or it's you know, party politics, and then race politics, and then now we even have gender identity politics. And the general notion is that we want to be free. We want to be free. That's generally what the political impetus is, that we want to organize society in such a way that we're free. Free from being prejudiced by the viewpoint of anybody else, by any other observer. So we want to be free to identify ourselves as belonging to any category or subcategory that we want. Isn't it? That's the general tendency. I want to be free. And so politics strives to deliver that to us. Unfortunately, politics cannot deliver the freedom that we really seek. It can only categorize and recategorize and decategorize and try through a process of democracy to give us the freedom to vote for the conceptions which we think will help us the most. So now, 30 years ago, someone came to me and, we were the only organization at the time to be talking about the difference between the body and the soul. So everywhere we went, we had this phrase. We have certain mahavakyas, certain great pronouncements. And one of them is, you're not that body. So in the 1970s, early 80s, anybody that had a sneaking suspicion that the biology that they were born with was not the biology that they would like to remain with, they would come to ISKCON. They'd read one of Prabhupada's books and they would say, actually, I've always felt that I'm not my body. I've always felt that I'm something other than this body. And you guys are the only people to be talking about this kind of stuff, because they couldn't take it anywhere else. This was before any terminology like transgender, transphobia, but there was a clinic in Switzerland that people had heard of that would perform what was then called, which was really new, which was called a sex change operation. No one quite knew what went on. They didn't know the details. So someone came to me and he said, my friend is going for an operation in Switzerland. Can you talk to him? Because I know that you guys talk about all this kind of stuff. And I said, do we? Okay. So I talked to this person and he poured his heart out. He poured his heart out. He said, I'm a man. He said, but I've always felt that I'm not a man. I've always felt that I'm a woman, and I'm going to have a sex change operation in Switzerland. And I just wanted to speak to you people because you're the only people who will understand what I'm going through, because you know that I'm not this body. And I said, I was very sympathetic to him. Of course, you have to be sympathetic because people are going through this massive tidal wave of emotions. They're stuck in a body that they don't identify with. And they want to identify in another body, with another body. But here's the difficulty. What he was going on to was simply identifying with another gender. Okay? Jai Shri Krishna, Jai Shri Ram. So if you identify with another body, you're still pretty much stuck in the same situation. You're pretty much stuck in the same situation. Because material nature, or Maya, will not... Am I okay speaking about this kind of stuff? Is it all right? You're okay with it? I mean, I don't know who gets the Twitter feed and who's on social media and who thinks I've just, you know, he's an old proper disciple. Maybe he's lost his marbles a little bit, you know. But I deal with people in the world, and this is a conversation that people have, this identity politics, you know. Black Lives Matter, you know, white supremacist. I'm a communist. I'm alt-left. I'm alt-right. You're extreme right. You're far left. And people are trying to use material political labels, even gender labels, in order to describe each other. Well, here is where Vedic culture can really help people. There's two words. One is vyavaharika. Vyavaharika means conventional identity. Vyavaharika, conventional. And the other is paramarthika, or eternal identity, you see. So you cannot have devotees like ourselves who do not function on both levels. You don't get that. It doesn't work. Because for integration with others, you have a vyavaharika identity. Okay? But you also have what you're trying to realize is your paramarthika identity, your ultimate identity, your eternal identity. So we are not trying to be transgender or transphobic or anything. We are trying to be transcendental. We're trying to be transcendental. But that does not mean that you lose your vyavaharika identity. For instance, Govindi here, he won't mind me using him again as an analogy. He comes to the passport place. He comes to, you know, when did you come? Yesterday, day before? 2 days ago, okay. And so he doesn't say, have you got your passport, sir? He doesn't say, I have no passport. I'm a resident of Vaikuntha. Well, we need to see some identity. My identity is pure spirit soul. I belong to no country. I do not belong to your nation. Well, I'm sorry, sir, you can't come into the United Kingdom unless we see who you are. You can see who I am simply by looking at me. They would raise their eyebrows and they would start looking from side to side. Yeah, Bob, we got a nutter. Where have you come from, sir? Where have you just come from? I come from Vaikuntha. And where are you going to? I wish to go back to Vaikuntha. How long are you planning on staying in England? I'm staying here very temporarily, because everything is temporary. Your country is also temporary. Do you mind lifting up your shirt, sir? We just want to see that you don't have any bombs underneath. They would think he was mad, because he's using his paramarthika identity in order to do something within society. It doesn't work. You give your passport in, the passport man looks at the photograph, looks at you, and you can get on with life. We do have that identity. You know, are you man or woman? I am simply spirit soul. I'm neither male nor female. I do not answer to any of your labels. And wouldn't it be nice? We have devotees like this, actually. The one was drafted into the army. He had to do national service. But he didn't want to fight. Didn't want to go join the army. He wanted to live in the ashram. And so when he went for an interview with the chief military officer, the officer asked him, he said, so where have you come from? And he answered like that. And immediately he got the rubber stamp, unfit for military service. See, you try this in Israel, then you don't have to join the IDF. You just go there and say, I'm simply a soul in transit through your world. I'm on the way to another world. See, all of that is true, but it won't get you a job. It won't get you a job in the world. It won't get you on in the world. So we have two identities, just so you understand. And so when we say male devotee, female devotee, people come and they say, oh, I thought you people were off the bodily platform. Why do you refer to people as male devotees and female devotees? Because wherever there's a remaining attachment to the body and the sexual identity, then we discriminate. Discrimination is a bad thing where such discrimination is not necessary. And when a person is off the bodily platform, then no such discrimination is required, and that person will not receive prejudice. That's the difference between Srila Vyasadeva and Sukadeva Goswami. They both walked through a pond where there was a group of girls bathing. When Srila Vyasadeva walked past them, they all put their clothes on. When they saw Sukadeva Goswami walking by, they could see that he was not interested in anything in this material world, and they just carried on as normal. You see the difference? Okay. We have to have this assumed identity in order for a marriage to work. Okay, I'm looking at our newlyweds here. One on the extreme left of me here, one on the extreme right. They're doing what people do in our Hare Krishna. Could you just give us a wave? Okay, give us a wave. There we are, and the newlyweds. They just got married. Now, part of the wedding was not that I said to them, okay, you're a spirit soul, you're a spirit soul, you're two spirit souls. You're exactly the same. When you do a wedding, you recognize the Vyavaharika identity of someone. Okay. So anyway, I wanted to talk about Brahmins. So we're talking about... this is interesting, actually. I just read yesterday. This ties in with ancient Greek philosophy. And the Bible begins, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. I always wanted to use that in a morning class at Bhaktivedanta Manor. And there was a philosopher in ancient Greece called Pelagio. And just before the Bible, the original Bible, was translated into Greek, which was the first Bible, there was this philosophical conception that there was God, whoever he, she, it might be, and there was an intermediary. And there was an intermediary that created the world. And this intermediary was known as Logos. So the original Greek words are, in the beginning was Logos. Okay? And Logos was God, and Logos was, and God was, how does it go? God was with the Word. So we also have this conception that there is God, and there is Logos. There is the full incarnation of the Word, who's known as Brahma. And it is Brahma, the Brahma God, who creates this world. Not Brahman, but Brahma. So in the beginning, there is Brahma. And the Puranas say that different parts of Brahma gave birth to different types of human beings. From the face came the Brahmins. From the arms came the Kshatriyas. From the thighs came the Vaishyas. And from the feet came the Sudras. This is echoed in the Manu Samhita. And the Manu Samhita says that Lord Brahma gave activities to each of those personality types according to their modes of nature. You see, people want to be free from identities that are given by someone else. I don't want you to label me. And in exchange, I'm not going to label you. But to have a world that's free from labels is a world where there's chaos. Because you can only interact with each other on the basis of that Vyavaharika identity. Do you see? Do you understand? Give me a nod if you kind of... You can only find your way to the gent's toilet or the lady's toilet. Now they have the whole thing about toilets. That we don't know, maybe we should have a unisex toilet, but that means unisex changing rooms where anybody can go, because of course if you're transgender... Transgender is not a new thing. It was in Vedic culture, it was called Tritiya Prakriti. They have always been there. They were known as eunuchs. Definition of a eunuch is that a male whose mind does not become disturbed by any woman. Okay, this is a eunuch. You're very good for looking after the harem, but you can't take sannyas. Huh? Such men cannot take sannyas because there's nothing to renounce. They were never interested in the first place. You can't renounce the company of women if you were never interested in women in the first place. So sometimes people say, oh, he's a gay man, he'd make a very good sannyasi because he's so detached. No, he wouldn't. He wouldn't. I know we do that sometimes in ISKCON, but we shouldn't, because Shastra says we shouldn't. So everybody has their own code of behavior according to their psychophysical identity. And the psychophysical identity is given by the three modes of material nature. Or by your own desire to become resistant to the pushings of the three modes of nature. When you become resistant to the pushings of the three modes of nature, then you can rise in your social identity also. But it's based on your quality, not by a label that someone gives you. So activities are based on how you interpret the world through your senses. Basically, how much desire you have to acquire and enjoy what is around you. You have less desire to acquire and enjoy, the more mode of goodness you are, and the more brahminical you become. Okay? Brahmins have more of a service tendency, Shudras have more of an enjoyment tendency. So it's somewhere along the... We're all somewhere on the spectrum. All somewhere on the Varnashram spectrum. And it doesn't mean, oh, I was initiated last week, therefore I have no Varna, no Ashram, no social identity. No, you... Oh, come on. Come on. You do. If you have no desire to enjoy anything at all in the world, then that's something different. But let us see, 3 weeks after initiation, how you are. So, for the Brahmins whose foot water Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would wash, these Brahmins are described in the following way. If you have these qualities, you're a Brahmin. If you have a Brahmin mum and a Brahmin dad, the tendency is that by the force of karma, you took birth in a Brahmin family because you have those tendencies. Otherwise, why would you take birth in a Brahmin family? But you have to manifest those qualities in order to stay a member of the Brahmin community. Where it is only by birthright, but not by quality, then you have a pseudo-Brahmin, or Brahma Bandhu. And those can cause great problems in society. You don't want to drink their foot water. But those persons that are walking in Brahman, those persons that are dedicated. So what is it? What does a Brahmin do? Firstly, let's hear about the qualities they have inside them before we hear about what things they do outside. So Krishna says, chapter 18, verse 42, Shamo damas tapa shocham kshantir arjavam evacha gyanam vigyanam astikyam brahma karma swabhavajam. This is the list. Let's chant these very loudly to keep ourselves awake. Peacefulness. Peacefulness. Self-control. Self-control. Austerity. Austerity. Purity. Tolerance, honesty, knowledge, wisdom, and religiousness. These are the natural qualities by which the Brahmins work. So someone said to me the other day, they said, can you tell me what the Hare Krishnas believe in? So I listed these things. And they said, oh, that's very good. You see? If someone says, well, what do the Hare Krishnas believe in? Oh, well, we believe there's a goddess, and she comes down in the form of a plant, and every morning at 5 o'clock we walk around the plant. You know, that's not preaching, folks. That's not very helpful. Okay? But if you say, these are the qualities, we believe in peacefulness, people go, oh, do you? That's very good. We believe in self-control. We believe in austerity. These are revolutionary things to say in society these days. They're all leaving. Is it something personal? I've put on something this morning. So then comes, oh, there's so many of them going. So then, yes, everybody can go. Go, go, go. Go, go, get out. So then this results in some qualities, some activities, because as you have the qualities inside you, so you'll do things on the outside. You can't always judge a person by what they do outside, but it's a pretty good indication. Okay? It's just like the other day, the army went and they put the president of Zimbabwe under house arrest. And it's about time too. He's 93. The country has gone into mass inflation. A loaf of bread will cost you 1 trillion Zimbabwean dollars. That's how rampant inflation has gone. Okay? $1 trillion will buy you a loaf of bread. So everybody's a trillionaire in the country. So no one has done worse for the country than this president. But he says, my time has not yet come. He's 93. Prabhupada said, a person who's not a Kshatriya, but is a Sudra, he will never want to leave his post. But one of the qualities of a Kshatriya is knowing when it's time to get out. That's a Kshatriya. He knows when to fight, but he also knows when to get out. So the army has taken the country over. He's under house arrest, and now yesterday they're negotiating which country he will go to next and take all the billions that he has taken. He's ripped off the country, and where will he go to spend those billions? I used to live in Africa. I lived in Africa for 2 years. I can't tell you how many African leaders did exactly the same thing and ended up in Riyadh with 16 wives, squandering the billions that they took in taxes and salted away in a Swiss bank account. It is just par for the course. So anyway, here we see the same thing. So the army went on the television a couple of days ago and said, this is not a coup. This is not a coup. Okay, it looks like a coup. The sounds of bullets coming from the presidential compound, that sounds like a coup. The army coming on the television, that definitely looks like a coup. Okay? So, if it looks like a coup and sounds like a coup, it's a coup. And I've been in a country where a coup happens because we had a Hare Krishna temple in Nairobi on one hill, and on the other hill was the radio station. And about 11 o'clock at night, all the brahmacharis, all us brahmacharis in the ashram heard, there goes the radio station. It's another coup. It's another attempted coup. Now, coup means you go into panic mode. Because as devotees, a lot of us were white people. And when the black people have a coup, you have to hide under the bed. Or hope that you've got some friends in the local African community. Anyway, so when it looks like a Brahmin, sounds like a Brahmin, and when he acts like a Brahmin, there's usually some Brahminical qualities going on inside. So what happens? What does a person do on the outside that would suggest that he's peaceful, self-controlled, austere, pure, tolerant, honest, knowledge, wise, and religious? Okay? What happens? What kind of work, what kind of a job would that person have? What would they do? How would they make their bread and their butter? Because at the end of the day, how you interact with society gives you bread and butter. Okay? Poverty does not get you on the path back to Godhead. Okay? Poverty is not noble. Okay? Neither will being rich get you back to Godhead. Okay? Being rich is not noble. But being godly will get you to God. Okay? So rich or poor, it doesn't matter. But every person must, at the end of the day, must have his hot chapati, or his beans on toast. Whatever your particular persuasion is, it's usually some bread at the end of the day. So this is what a Brahmin does. He does yajna, or he does yajana. He does yajna. He does sacrifices. He communicates with the gods. He does yajana. He does sacrifices for other people. Adhyayana, adhyapana. He learns the Vedas, and he teaches the Vedas. And dana, he gives gifts, gives in charity. And pratigraha. So dana also means he teaches. And pratigraha means he also receives. Now, five of these don't get you much money. They really don't. They don't get you much money. So what does the Brahmin do? So then Manu Samhita says he can also do some other things. He can also do some other things if he absolutely needs to. But as you go down, Manu says, this is a top-class Brahmin, second-class Brahmin, third-tier Brahmin, scraping the bottom of the Brahmin category. Next stage, fifth category Brahmin, almost a Kshatriya. And so we go down. And I just want to give you some word definitions just before we finish here. We have this word, upadhyaya. Upadhyaya. Has anyone heard that word, upadhyaya? So, We hear this word, upadhyaya. You'll hear it if you go. And this is why I'm spending some time on it. Adhyaya means any portion of the Vedas. Adhyapaka means one who teaches any portion of the Vedas. So you're Brahmin, you're also an adhyapaka. Adhyapana is the teaching of the Vedas. And adhyayana is the learning of the Vedas. You getting it? Adhyaya means chapter. So chapters, okay. So the prefix upa denotes something that is subsidiary to the main thing being denoted. So we have the angas of the Veda, Vedangas, and then they have the upangas. We have the Puranas, and then we have the Upapuranas. And we have gurus, and we have upagurus. Sometimes we in ISKCON we have this big, you know, big panic because we don't have enough Sanskrit words to cover the things that we want to say in contemporary ISKCON. Well, that's a real shame because Sanskrit has a word for everything, because everything we have a problem with has also happened before. Okay, so an upaguru is someone who is an assistant to the guru. Okay, we don't have to call him, oh, he's a diksha or shiksha, or you're confused. Upaguru, or one who is an assistant to a guru. So upa adhyapaka or upadhyaya means one who teaches the Vedas as a co-worker or assistant to the guru. Now, this is very important, the next bit, okay? Definition of the word acharya. The acharya is not one who teaches for a living. He establishes his gurukul, okay? You want to know what a gurukul is? I'll tell you. And he teaches for one reason and one reason only, not to make a salary from the gurukula, but to carry out his brahminical duty of making sure that vidya, or knowledge, I'm reading from an excellent book, it's called The Guru and Disciple Book. Really good book. And making sure that the vidya, or knowledge, in which... I'm sorry. Shameless promotion. The vidya in which he is proficient does not cease with him, but is kept alive forever. When the student joins the gurukul, the acharya does not utter a word about fees or dakshina. Okay, that word doesn't come from the acharya. It is only after a student has completed his education that the acharya mentions it. So when we have an initiation ceremony and the disciples go around and they collect pennies and they give it to the guru, that's not guru dakshina. That's called Brahmin dakshina. So guru dakshina is what you give when the guru sees that your education has been complete. So you begin your education, that's called diksha. You complete your education, okay, by receiving shiksha from the guru. But now, of course, we've made it into a corporate endeavor now. So really now the guru gives you beads, and he may give you occasional classes of inspiration. There's two things here, upadesh and upakhyana. Upakhyana means the generic instructions, because you're sitting there, the guru's, your guru, the one that you took initiation of, your ISKCON guru, is speaking to everybody. But you find it inspiring because he's your guru. But this is not upadesh. It's not instructions. So the guru is meant to give personalized instructions to you because you're the shishya. Otherwise, don't get involved with this person. Why are you getting involved with the person who you will never speak to? And so what happens in our contemporary ISKCON is that people have a relationship with a guru and they don't actually speak to the person, they don't hear from the person, and then they come and they say, I'm not feeling very good in my spiritual life, I feel a bit weak. Of course you feel weak, because you haven't spoken to your guru for 4 years. How is that possible? So, either the guru, or a designated upaguru, or an upa-upaguru, but someone has to take responsibility for your education. Otherwise, we find 5 years go by, 8 years go by, and devotees don't know some of the basics. They really don't. And it's quite shocking. And so the educational system within ISKCON is really due for a bit of oomph. Okay? Just thought that was a party political broadcast on behalf of the Guru Reform Party. Okay. So the Manusmriti that says, one who teaches for a livelihood is not called an acharya. He's called an upadhyaya. He's called an assistant to the acharya. He is not the same as an acharya. One who teaches for a fee, in which he says to the student, yeah, I'll teach you the Vedas, I'll teach you the Bhagavatam, but, you know, I don't do this for nothing, you know. You have to give me something. That's called, when devotees teach courses, that's not called an acharya, it's not called an upadhyaya, it's called a britak. It's valid, but you're on the third tier of guruship. A britak adhyapaka. Okay? So he teaches a part of the Veda and receives a salary for it in return. This is called britak adhyapaka. However, we have a problem as Kali Yuga goes by. Kali Yuga is that winter phase of the cosmos where gradually brahmanas who are acharyas, they fade and they fade, their strength fades and fades, and you know, we don't see so many of them. And the very Bhagavatam that gave us that gives us the beginnings of Kali Yuga told us that there was a young boy born in a Brahmin family. His name was Sringi, and he cursed a king. Now, there's always meant to be a very good relationship between the Brahmins and the kings, because that's how society functions. Otherwise, you look at European history is problematic. Either the kings were listening to the priests, or they were burning the priests at the stake in the marketplace in Oxford and Cambridge. Okay? So, a very turbulent relationship between the kings and their priests. But there's meant to be a good relationship. But here's the beginning of the bad relationship. The king put a dead snake around the neck of his father, and as a result, the boy cursed him to die within 7 days. And this is a manifestation of the age of Kali. So, the acharyas gradually disappeared. Acharyas for whom teaching was not a means of livelihood, they dwindled in number. And as a consequence, if that happens, the number of upadhyayas increased. So the name upadhyay, instead of denoting a teacher of inferior status, came to denote a teacher of prestige. So now, today, even an acharya in India is called an upadhyay. So this is how we get Bengalis with names like Mukherjee. Mukhopadhyaya becomes Mukherjee. Chatur Upadhyaya, meaning one who teaches the four Vedas, Chatur Upadhyaya becomes Chatterjee, and Banda Upadhyaya becomes Banerjee. Okay? Any Bengalis here? Huh? So Mukherjee, Chatterjee, Banerjee, these are Upadhyayas. So Bandya Upadhyaya. So Mukha means the Vedas, since they come from the mouth. Chatur means the four Vedas, and Vandya means the teacher of respect. Okay. So then, gradually, the number of brahmanas, and I'm getting to the point now, the number of brahmanas that would teach for nothing gradually dwindles, because unfortunately, if you have brahmins who teach for nothing, then that family has a tendency to become poverty-stricken and die early. You see, Brahmins live on charity. And all through the Vedas, we find now what we think are coded messages that the Brahmins must have written in there, because it says, give a cow in charity to a Brahmin. You know, give gold in charity to a Brahmin. And then people who are less, perhaps, charitable, they look at that and they think, just see, the Brahmins wrote the Vedas, and they wrote themselves into the Vedas, so that they would become rich. It's not a case. That is there on the teachings of Lord Brahma himself. Because if you don't have that, then people who teach for nothing die out. If there's no charity towards Brahmins, that community dies out. And you have people who would teach for something. And if they teach something to a king, then they will teach for a big something. So then you get priests or Brahmins who are in the employment of kings. You also get Brahmins who are afraid to lose their post by speaking out against the king. Don't you, Govinda? And so they will be teaching for a salary, and they will be told by the king what to speak. And as soon as you get a Brahmin who's been told by the king what to speak, you no longer have a Brahmin, you simply have a Sudra. Do you understand? So Brahmin means one who's free to speak as he likes. Kshatriya is a person who protects the Brahmins. And that is the eternal relationship between them. Mahabharata says a Brahmin is someone whose mouth is like a razor blade. When he opens his mouth, disciple of Madhvacharya, they said when he opened his mouth, the words came out like a hammer. Came out like a hammer. You sat in front of him and you'd be smashed to pieces. Okay, hammer mouth, they would call him. Hammer mouth. So a Brahmin's mouth is like a hammer, like a razor blade. Cut, 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 cut. But his heart is like butter. You see? He has affection for everybody. But what comes out of his mouth is chop, chop, chop. A Kshatriya, he has a mouth like butter. He can speak sweetly. He can do diplomacy. Yes, of course. I think our two families, by the union, by this marriage, should be peaceful. And we can be peaceful. But the heart is like a razor blade. He can do diplomacy. He can do sweet butter-like talking. But his heart is like a razor blade. And this is the difference between the two varnas. So, I just want to... just finish by saying, I just want to read something. This is from the fifth canto. Srila Prabhupada says, while instructing Maharaj Yudhishthira about the symptoms of guna and karma, Narada Muni said that these symptoms must govern the division of society. Must govern the division of society. In other words, if a person born in the family of a Brahmana has the symptoms of a Shudra, he should be designated as a Shudra. Similarly, if a Shudra has Brahminical qualities, he should be designated a Brahmin. Sixth canto, Prabhupada says the same thing. Prabhupada comes from a society in which really you have no idea how degraded Brahmanas in India became. And there was a movement of, really they were called the Black Shirts. The Black Shirts, they were anti-Brahmins. It started in South India in the 1920s, and then gradually it spread all over India. And you got a very famous Bengali movie director called Satyajit Roy. Satyajit Roy. And in every movie, no matter what the story was, there'd be a political statement in there. I think Bhakti Charuswami's father was friends with Satyajit Roy. So anyway, every movie he'd have something to say about pseudo Brahmins and pseudo gurus. You know, one, there's a guru on a train, and there's a disciple looking up at his guru like this. A Bengali film, of course, and the sun is just rising, and they can see it outside the train carriage as the train's going along. And the guru is gesturing with his hand like this, and the disciple turns to the other passengers and says, see, my guru can even make the sun rise in the morning. And then in another, a Brahmin, he beats a servant, he beats his Sudra servant to death. But then the person dies in the field, and it's the Brahmin's field. And he wants to take the Sudra out of the field, but of course as a Brahmin he doesn't want to touch someone so low, and he doesn't want to touch a dead body, so he puts rope around the legs of the body of his former servant who served him for many years, and he drags the body out of the field. And as he's dragging the body, he's chanting Om Apavitro Pavitrova Sarvavastam Gadobiva. So in this, Satyajit Roy is making the statement that, just see the hypocrisy. He's thinking, I must stay pure. But in his purity, he's really being the most uncharitable person you could hope to imagine. And in the life of Apu, another movie, it's about a Brahmin who's so lazy. He's always promising his wife that tomorrow I'm going to work. Tomorrow, you just see, I'm a Brahmin, I have to stay faithful to my tradition, I'm going to write this play, and such will give me money for writing this play, it's just coming. And of course the wife goes into poverty, because there's absolutely no money in the family at all. The husband dies, leaving the wife in poverty. So Satyajit Roy is making a commentary here on the Brahmin community. But before that, even in the 1800s, Brahmins would initiate based on the dakshina that would come from a rich disciple. And they would do this in places, in holy places, like the burial place of a famous Gaudiya Vaishnava, and because they had to pay a tax. So although the tendency was there, the tendency was exaggerated by the jizya, the Muslim tax that everyone has to pay if they're non-Muslim. So the Muslim code of ethics, political ethics, is that you're an equal citizen if you're a Muslim. If you're a non-Muslim, you're a second-class citizen, but we will tolerate your existence if you pay a tax known as a jizya. But you'll have to be known, you'll have to be labeled by us as a dhimmi. So because you're a dhimmi who lives in India, you are a Hindu. So this is where the word Hindu comes from. It's a Muslim word to describe people in that part of India. And anyway, so the Brahmins would also have to pay the tax. So where are they going to get the tax from if they're poor Brahmins? Well, from some disciples. So it got to the point where a person was giving initiation and giving absolutely no instruction whatsoever beyond, as Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati said, simply blowing in the disciple's ear. You blew some wind in the disciple's ear, and that was your diksha. So this was a situation that Bhaktivinoda Thakur preached against, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati preached against, and Srila Prabhupada, in all of his purports, you see the pseudo-Brahmin, corrupt Brahmins, the Brahmins, you see the cheating Brahmins, like that. And that's how we get this in a lot of purports. Okay. So then, maybe I should finish here. Prabhupada says, 7th canto, if one was born in a Brahmin family and has acquired the Brahminical qualifications, he is to be accepted as a Brahmin. Otherwise, he should be considered a Brahma Bandhu. Similarly, if a Shudra acquires the qualities of a Brahmana, although he was born in a Shudra family, he is not a Shudra. Because he has developed the qualities of a Brahmana, he should be accepted as a Brahmana. Here it comes to us. The Krishna consciousness movement is meant to develop these Brahminical qualities. Regardless of the community in which one was born, if one develops the qualities of a Brahmin, he should be accepted as a Brahmin, and he may then be offered the order of sannyas. Now, when a person becomes initiated, especially when he becomes initiated as a Brahmin, that doesn't automatically mean he's fit to be a manager in our movement. We have seen some of the greatest problems arise in our movement because we put a person who was a non-manager, they should never be let anywhere near accounts or money or management or fundraising. They just keep them away from that. But because they're second initiated, they were immediately put in a post and they were free to cause havoc, which they did. Sometimes we have a person who is a non-Brahmin by dint of his qualities, but he takes sannyas. And he still doesn't develop Brahminical qualities, even though he's a sannyasi. And then we're all very surprised when he drifts away from the sannyas ashram. This is based on internal qualities. Therefore, in the Madhva Sampradaya, you don't get to take sannyas unless they've looked at your astrology, unless they've looked at your birth, unless they've looked at your parentage, and they read your palm. Only if you have tyaga, or renunciation, as part of your qualities, your astrological qualities, your life qualities. Only if you have that do you get to be a sannyasi. And up until just recently, they didn't have a fall down of sannyasis in 800 years. So in ISKCON, we should go by qualities, not by cloth, not by bamboo sticks, not by names, not by pieces of string. Let's look at the actual quality of the person, because that's what A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada says in his purports. And if we follow Prabhupada's purports, we will always be safe. Hare Krishna. Thank you very, very much for listening. Donations at the door will be gratefully accepted, because I'm a Britak Apadhyaya. Just kidding. Of course I'm kidding. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. And all of you sitting at home, thank you so much.